I listened to a tape of Ray, probably a couple months ago, and I just really enjoyed the tape. It was fantastic. And today, we went down and had a little lunch before we came up here, and I got to know him a little better. And he's really a delightful, refreshing person, and I know that you're going to enjoy hearing him as much as I enjoyed hearing the tape. Ray?
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ray Vowell, and I am an alcoholic. And it's delightful to be here with you on Founders Day. It's delightful to be in Akron. And I've already apologized to Tom, and I'll apologize to the committee. When Tom called and asked me if I would come, he said, this is Tom from Akron, and I'd like you to come and lead for me. Well, I didn't know what lead meant. I had just moved to Hogansville, Georgia, and if you don't know where that is, let me clear that up real fast. I know some of you are in the dark about where Hogansville is. It's between Louise and Grantville. It's bounded by Lone Oak on the east and West Point on the west, so now you won't have any trouble at all finding it. Now, if you're not smart enough to figure that out, it's 45 miles southwest of Atlanta going toward Montgomery. If you go to Hogansville, it will be on purpose because you don't go there to go anywhere else. You don't go through there to get anywhere. You just go there. There are those who went there and never came back. But when Tom called me, I had just moved there, and he said, I'd like you to come and lead for me. And I said, okay, what? And he said, I want you to be the opening lead at Founders Day. And I said, all right, good, when? And he said, June the 15th. And I said, all right, that's fine, where? And he said, Akron, Ohio. And I said, okay. And I think he was very disappointed that I didn't get excited about all this, but you see, there were three things involved. Number one, I didn't know who he was. And number two, I didn't know what Founders Day was. And number three, I'd never led anything in my life. I had been a follower. I thought I was the leader, but I always found out that even being the leader, I was two steps behind. So let me apologize. I am happy to be here where it all started. I really did not know about Founders Day because I came into AA in Texas. And when I finally sobered up, I realized where I was. I sobered up in Irving, Texas in 1971 on July the 20th, and there was 140,000 people there, and I was the last one to find out I was an alcoholic. The rest of them knew it before I got there. So, you know, Akron has always had a special meaning for me, but not because of Founders Day. But I'd like to tell you a little story real fast. In 40-something years ago, a lady named Marty Mann made a 12-step call on a lady named Esther down in Houston, Texas. And a few years after that, Esther made a 12-step call, on a fellow named Al B., who later moved to Dallas, Texas. And sometime after that, Al B. made a 12-step call on a fellow named Lester F. And then Lester F. later made a 12-step call on a fellow named W.O. W.O. made a 12-step call on a man named John C., who later made a 12-step call on a boy named James W. And on July the 19th, 1971, James W. and John C. made a 12-step call on me. So my AA came directly from Akron. But you see, the beautiful part about that is this, that the year Marty Mann made the 12-step call on Esther, I was only 2 years old. And God improved the program and prepared the program and developed the program and made it bigger and better. And then in July of 1971, when I was ready for it, he had it there for me. So I'm proud to be here today. I'm emotional as I stand here today in the city where it all started. I've never had any problems with this being a God-given program. By the way, let me clear up something. Now, you know, one of the other beauties of the program, and that is that Father Tom sits there next to me, a Southern Baptist pastor, and we smile at each other like we like each other, you know, and we really do. You see, because it really doesn't matter what our different doctrines and our different theologies are, we both come from the same program. I don't know. I know something about Baptist theology and doctrine, and I'm sure that Father Tom has studied those pagan ones that we practice. My basic theology is this, and I had a young seminarian ask me the other day after I had received my doctorate. All my life I'd waited on some seminarian to ask me a question. And this young preacher comes up to me and he says, "Dr. Vowell," and God, I just swelled up. And you know, when I swell up, that's swelling. And he said, "What is your basic philosophy of life?" And I said, "Well, I guess it would be that God gives me what I need when I need it as I'm capable of taking care of it." And he said, "Well, what is your theology?" And I said, "Well, God loves me. And His Son, Jesus Christ, died for me. And that makes me very special. And it really doesn't make any difference what you think about me, or whether or not you like me or not. God proved 2,000 years ago that He loved me. And He never stopped." So, you know, I am a Baptist minister. I'm a Southern Baptist minister. I pastor a Southern Baptist church in Hogansville, Georgia. And I'm no more ashamed of being a Baptist preacher than I am of being an alcoholic. They're both incurable. You have to learn to live with them. You just have to learn a program of daily recovery. You know, maybe someday when we get wherever it is we're going to all wind up, we'll all recover from being Baptist and Catholic and alcoholics and everything else, and we'll be Christians. I hope someday that comes. It won't happen as long as the church has anything to do with it, but someday maybe we can. I have discovered, Tom asked me, he said, "How do you want to be listed on the program?" And I said, "Dr. Ray V, because I've worked for years and years and years to get a doctorate, and I got it May the 18th. And I don't care how you feel about that either. I'm darn proud of it. You know, I got a PhD in Christian counseling and Christian psychology. And my sponsor, he treated that exactly like he's treated everything else I've ever done, you know, with disdain. And he said, "I want you to understand that a PhD is something like the curly tail on a pig. It don't add a damn bit of meat. It's just a little more class." So, I've had to live with that too. But I have come to the conclusion that, you know, alcoholics are not the only crazy people in the world. We're just the only ones that know why we are. I have a clinic, and I listen to people all the time have the same problems we have, and I want to tell them, "Go out and get drunk and come back, and I'll send you to AA and you can solve these problems." I don't know what to do. I don't know what to tell people who are sober and don't drink and still crazy as I was. Where do you send them, you know? But, you know, I have a feeling that the whole world's got some problems. You know, it seems to me, I live in a negative society, and Father Tom, I'm sure you do too. You know, I never yet had anybody come to my office and knock on the door and say, "Hey, I came by to tell you how good I feel today." You know, my phone rings at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not somebody wants to tell me how great things are going, I can assure you. You know, everybody calls me and says, "You know, I've got a problem. I've got trouble." You know. And I began to notice that the whole world is kind of negative. They're goofy. They really are. And I can come to AA and talk about the world being goofy. If I do that in the pulpit, people get offended and the offering goes down. It's not easy to live out of the poor box, I can tell you that. I was walking through the, talking about crazy people. I was walking through one of the malls in Georgia the other day. We do have one. And I saw a sign on a window that said, "Ears pierced while you wait." Well, I walked in there and I said, "Lady, I don't have time to wait. Could I leave my ears and pick them up later?" And she called the security guard. I went on up to the post office, and they've got a sign on the front door of the post office that said, "No dogs allowed except C&I dogs." Who in the hell's supposed to read that? You ever buy your wife a box of candy and take it home and give it to her and have her say, "Is that for me?" "No. So I bought it for the dog. I want you to give it to him, you know." You ever slip and fall? You ever slip in public and fall down? Laying there flat on your butt, looking straight up. And inevitably somebody come out and say, "Did you fall?" Said, "No, I'm hoping a lady will come by and see up her dress or something." We're not the only people in the world that have problems. We're just the only ones that know what ours are caused from. There are a lot of things that I could talk to you about this today, and there are a lot of memories that I have, especially as I stand in this city and think back on the things that have been prepared for us. When I think back upon the price that other people paid that we might have life, and that we might not have just life, but that we might have a happy life. I don't think much today about drinking. There was a time when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I concentrated on talking about drinking and recovery from drinking. And I thank God that in this program, after almost 13 years, I have reached the point where drinking just doesn't occur to me very much. You see, I don't remember very many funny things that happened to me when I drank. There was a time in my life when I could conjure up stories of a lot of good times and fun and games. But if I were honest with you today, I'd have to tell you that I had to reach way back into my life to find any of those. And when I came into AA in 1971, there had not been any of those kind of experiences for 5 or 6 years. My life existed and consisted of just trying to survive one more day on your money by lying to you and conning you. So today I'm not going to dwell on any type of drink, a drunkalog at all, for several reasons. Number one is I don't remember a great deal of what happened to me when I drank. And when I talk about drinking experiences, I have a tendency to lie. Another reason is my wife's sitting up here and you can see her face, and when I lie, she frowns. And who wants to, have the gong go off every time you tell a lie? But I think the most important reason of all is that it's no longer necessary for me to prove to you that I'm a bigger drunk than you are. There was a time in my life when I would have had to try to convince you. I'm sure that there are people in here who drank a heck of a lot more than I did, and great. I'm glad you're here. I'm sure that there are people in here today who never drank nearly as much as I did. That's great too. Neither one of those facts is important. It's only important today for me to know that I can no longer drink alcohol successfully. It's only important for me to understand that for my program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I must accept the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. I said my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I want to tell you something. I have some personal opinions here that I'm going to express that may not reflect your idea of what AA is. And if you don't like them, throw them away. I'm going back tomorrow to Georgia, and we'll all be happy. You know, I'm not an expert. I used to be. When I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came in as an absolute expert. In fact, I was teaching beginners before I'd been in the program 30 days. Because I found out very early in the program an anatomical fact, and I hope you learned this in nursing school, and that is that the eardrum and the jawbone don't work at the same time. If you talk, you don't have to listen. You cannot talk and listen at the same time. I knew that. And so when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody said, you must admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life has become unmanageable. And gosh, I did. I came to AA in 1971 because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I had lied to everybody that would listen to me. I had stolen from everybody that had anything I could get my hands on. I had conned everybody that would believe a word I said. And I had reached the end of my rope, and so had you. I have yet to meet a man or woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who came to AA because people loved them so much they wanted to escape. I have never met a man or a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who came because their wife was so crazy about them they needed some rest. We come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because we're desperate. We don't have anywhere else to go. We have lied, we've cheated, we've conned, and we have used everything that we can possibly use, and we come out of desperation. And I came into AA, and they said, you must admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life's become unmanageable. And I said, okay, I do. That wasn't hard. You know, I'd admit that frogs were purple if it would get me what I wanted. I didn't care. You know, I'd admit almost anything. They didn't say I had to believe it. Nobody told me I had to accept that. They just said, admit you're powerless over alcohol, and I did. You know what? I went home and told Faye. I said, I'm powerless over alcohol. She said, I know that. I went down and told my boss at work, you know. Now, it did surprise him a little bit, not my telling him, just my being there. I said, I was working for a doctor, and he said, guess what? I'm powerless over alcohol. He said, the whole world knows that. I went down to the Dallas County Sheriff's Office. A fellow named Bill Decker was the sheriff of Dallas County at that time, and we knew each other real well. And I said, Sheriff Decker, I'm powerless over alcohol. And he said, yeah, I know. He said, you're still going to have to pay the fine. He said, either come up with the money or you're going to go do some time. See, I didn't mind admitting I was powerless over alcohol as long as I didn't have to believe it. Admit you're powerless over alcohol. One night a fellow came up to me. He said, I'm your sponsor. I said, I haven't chosen a sponsor yet. He said, you just did. I am. I said, I'm not sure I want you for a sponsor. He said, who said you had a choice? And I said, well, they told me. And he said, who's they? I said, well, everybody says. He said, who's everybody? Put a name to it. I said, well, the program said. And he said, don't ever say that because you don't have any idea what the program said. And I said, well, what does it mean to have a sponsor? And he said, we'll discuss it later. He said, number one, you must admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable. I said, oh, I admit that all the time. He said, yeah, but you don't believe it. You're still trying to run things. You see, I was sitting in a meeting. Somebody came in one night. I wasted so much time in them dumb old meetings. Gosh, hours and hours and hours sitting in them dumb old discussion meetings. Waiting for my turn. You see, I'd sit there and think about what I was going to say when my turn came. And then when my turn came, I would say my say, and then I'd spend the rest of the hour thinking about what I had said. Some of you are frowning about that. I got close to home, didn't I? But I want to say to you, if you don't get anything out of the AA program but what you bring to it, you're probably not going to get too sober. And I'd sit there in them dumb old meetings waiting for my turn to speak. And one night a fella came in and said one of the prettiest words I ever heard. Slip. God, I like that. He said, I had a slip. And everybody gathered around him and hugged on him, kissed his ears, run their fingers through his hair and says, God, we're glad you're back. Well, they wasn't even glad I was there. I'd been there all the time. Nobody hadn't kissed my ears. They were just barely tolerating me. I found out later why. And I thought, well, hey, wait a minute. I'm probably going to have a slip, and then I'll get the program. Doesn't everybody? I hope so. That was what I thought. Boy, I hope so. You see, I thought a slip was I'd be driving home from work one day and I'd suddenly come drunk. And then I could drink all I wanted to and nobody could blame me. I wanted to get drunk with dignity. I didn't want to be blamed for being drunk. I didn't want to get arrested for being drunk. I didn't want to puke on the porch and stuff like that. I just wanted to be dignified and have a few drinks. Over and over and over, I said that to myself. I just want to be dignified. I just want to have a few drinks. And so I took over. Boy, when I'd go to a meeting and they'd say, do you have anything you want to talk about? I'd say, let's talk about slips. And I waited. And I went to them dumb old meetings. And I kept waiting for my slip to come. And one night, a little fellow named Paul Mack, and I never will forget Paul. Paul's about this tall, weighs about 110 pounds. He's got glaucoma, got glasses this thick. And he got me by the arm, and he said, look, he said, let's me and you go over here in the Al-Anon room and let these folks have an AA meeting. I thought he wanted to tell me what a good job I was doing. So I went with Paul into the room, and he said, I want to tell you something, son. I've been in AA 14 years. And you are, without a doubt, the phoniest SOB we've ever had in here. And I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I quit and went home. And I told my wife, I'm not going back anymore. They don't appreciate me. And she said, I want to ask you one question. Why do you think he said that? What would he care? What difference would it make whether you get drunk or not to him? And so I called him up and I said, why did you do that to me? To me. He said, Ray, I want to tell you something. He said, we have nothing to share in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I experience strength and hope. And I have shared with you the experience that you're looking for in the hopes that you could avoid getting drunk. I don't know if you are or not, and I don't really care anymore. I'm not going to say anything else to you about it, but I want to point out a very simple fact to you. There are no slips in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, in order for you to take a drink, you don't have guts enough to drink in front of anybody because you've talked too much. And he said, you'll have to make a decision to go buy some whiskey, and if the truth were known, you probably have already done that, and boy, that made me mad as hell. I didn't know how he knew that. I had a pint of whiskey in the trunk of the car I was saving for a poor, sick, suffering alcoholic. Me. And Paul said, I want you to understand that what you're looking for does not exist, that before you can take a drink, you'll have to decide where you're going to do it. Then you'll have to decide to open the trunk of the car. Then you'll have to make a decision to take the bottle out of the trunk. And then you'll have to make another decision to take the top off the bottle. Then you'll have to decide whether or not to turn the bottle up. And even after you get the whiskey in your mouth, you'll have to decide whether or not to swallow it. And that's not a slip. That's design and that's plan. And then he put the cork on the whole thing. He says, and if you're ever fortunate enough to walk into another AA group and you have no guarantees, you'll have to look those people in the eye and you'll have to say to them, I got drunk because I wanted to be drunk more than I wanted to be sober. Because that's the only reason there is. And boy, I'll tell you what, that kind of tore my program up. I went on back down there and I said, well, I guess I am powerless over alcohol and I suppose my life is unmanageable. And I'll just sit over here in the corner. I won't drink, but I don't like it. But I'm going to tell you something, folks, and you work your program any way you want to, but I'm going to tell you something. If you attend meetings, whether you like it or not, my big book and my 12 and 12 tell me that if I come, eventually I'll come to. And when I come to, I'll come to believe. I was sitting in the beginners group Saturday night. I was chairing the beginners group. I already had 29 days sobriety. And I was teaching the newcomers. If you've never had a beginners group, folks, that's a joy to behold. And in the Dallas area, what they do is at 7 o'clock on Saturday night, they let everybody with less than 30 days sobriety have a meeting under the supervision of an old bleeding deacon so they can get the BS out of the way by 8 o'clock and have a real AA meeting. That's exactly what it amounts to. And I got to describe a beginner's meeting to you. Number one guy says, I used to drink shoe polish. Number two says, that ain't nothing. I used to drink kerosene. Lit. Number three guy says, I got drunk one time in Memphis and woke up in Nashville. Number four guy says, that ain't nothing. I got drunk one time in Hong Kong and woke up in Quebec, Canada in my car. Number five guy says, I've been married four times. Number six says, that ain't nothing. I've been married 12 times. Three times since lunch. Twice to my sister. And that's a beginner's meeting. And I'm sitting there waiting for my turn, wondering how in the world am I going to top this? We had an irritating son of a gun. Guy by the name of Curly G had 28 years of sobriety, and he was phony, he was a liar, he was a thief, and his socks didn't match. There was no truth in him. I hated him. He smiled all the time. He could stand here today and address this whole room full of people, and if he asked a question, he'd be looking straight at me. Curly was sitting in the beginners meeting while I chaired, and he said, I want to ask you people a question. Have any of you ever been so drunk you didn't remember what you did? And he looked straight at me. Well, of course. That's a point of honor with an alcoholic. And I said, of course I have. And he said, I want to ask you another question. Have you ever woke up in bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body? And I said, of course not. And he said, how do you know? I'm going to tell you something. I came to and I came to believe real fast. And I got up and I walked out. It was not funny to me. I ran. My sponsor lived 3 blocks from the meeting, from the club. And I ran 3 blocks over to his house. And he thought my middle name was Dumbass. Because he'd say, well, what do you want now, Dumbass? And I walked over and I rang his doorbell about 8 o'clock that night. And he came to the door and I was standing there with big tears running down my face. And he looked at me and he said, what now? And I said, I've just found out something. And he said, what's that? I said, I don't know what I've done. And he said, none of us do. And I said, I don't care about you. And I don't care about all them other people down there. I'm telling you, I don't know what I've done. And he said, well, what does that mean? And I said, that means that never again in my life can I look down on anybody. Because I don't know what I've done. And that means that I no longer have the right to judge anybody in this world because I don't know what I've done. And Al reached and got me by the arm and he said, it just might be that you're ready to take certain steps. And he took me in and he sat me down at his kitchen table. And I'll tell you, I almost took root there. For the next 12 months, Al said to me, and I know you've heard it said before, but Al literally said to me, you've got 2 ears and 1 mouth. You will listen twice as much as you talk. You will not speak in an AA meeting. You will not say anything about AA to anybody except to me. You will read the big book. You will read the 12 and 12. You will write an inventory, and you're going to practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, or you're going to stay the heck away from me. And I'm squalling, and I said, but if I leave, I'll die. And he said, you might as well. For the next year, Al, I don't know what it cost Al. Al was in business for himself, but every afternoon when I got off work, I had 40 minutes to get to the AA club. If we did not have a meeting in our home group, I had 30 minutes to get to my house, and Al would blow the horn. He blew the horn one time, and I was either in the car, and we went to an AA meeting, or he came in the house and we had a private meeting, and I only did that one time. I would get in the car with Al and he would say, what is step one? And I'd say, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. And he said, what does that mean? And I'd say, it has 3 meanings. Alcoholics Anonymous, we admitted and accepted, and absolute abstinence. And he said, well, what are you going to do with that? And I said, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And he said, what does that mean? And I said, that means that if I will believe in a power greater than I am, that through his help I can become sane again. And he'd say, how do you enlist the aid of that power? And I said, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And he'd say, what does God as you understand him mean? And I say, it does not mean God as I want him to be. It means God as he wants me to be and will give me the strength to become. And we'd go to an AA meeting. Sometimes on Saturday, Al would pick me up at 9 o'clock in the morning and we'd go to a meeting at 10 o'clock at the 24-hour club. We'd go at 12 o'clock to the big book group downtown. We'd go at 2 o'clock out to the Irving group. We'd go at 5 o'clock back downtown to the 24-hour club. At 8 o'clock, we'd go to Mesquite. At 10 o'clock, they had a round robin that lasted all night on Saturday night. And Faye will tell you she's not frowning when I say this. Sometimes I would be gone for 36 hours straight to AA meetings. And I would come home and my mind would be in a whirl. And I'd say, Al, I don't understand all this. He said, all you have to do is just don't drink today. And I said, well, Al, why are you telling me all this stuff? He said, I didn't tell you anything. We went to a meeting one time. I never will forget. We went to a meeting in Irving. And guy stood up. And all of you have seen these people, you know. Old fella got up and he said, I don't want to go into no long drunkalogue. But I took my first drink in 1924. And at 9:15, he was up to 1946. And I got up and walked out, and Al followed me, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I don't want to hear any more of that bull." And he said, "I'm going to tell you something. You're not sitting there for you. You're sitting there for him. Maybe he needs to say it." And the very least you can get out of any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is some patience and tolerance to help other people. We went back in and we sat down. The next night, Al came and picked me up, and he said, "Well," said, "we're going over to the the Mesquite Big Town group tonight." And I said, "Great." We went over, and we were about 5 minutes late, and we ran in. I grabbed a cup of coffee just in time to hear this man from the podium say, "I don't want to go into a long drunkalogue, but I took my first drink in 1924. I sat there until 10 o'clock. The next night, Al came and picked me up, and he said, "We're going over to the Preston group." I like the Preston group. That's the elite group in Dallas. Folks, I'm talking Lincoln Continental, you know, Cadillac Fleetwood, that kind of drunk, you know. They're old on them and all that, but they, you know, they still, nobody repossessed them. Some of them. And I love to go to the Preston group because they all had shoes. Most of them bathed, and it was pretty elite, a lot higher class than where I came in. And I'd go over there and sit and pretend to be one of them, you know. So we got over there about 10, 15 minutes early, and I got a cup of coffee and talked a little bit, and I sat down in the back, and I was looking around to see if there's any pretty girls there, you know, and all this sort of thing. And all of a sudden, I hear this man say, "Now, I don't want to go into a long drunkalogue, but I took my first drink in 1924. Friday night, Al came and he said, "You deserve a break." He said, "We're going there having an anniversary, an Al-Anon anniversary over at the Arlington group." And I said, "Phew, boy." So we get over to Arlington and we get our cake and our peanuts and our coffee. And I sit down and this sweet little old gray-haired lady gets up. And she says, "I don't want to take my husband's inventory, but he had his first drink in 1924. The next night, we went back down, the Wind Oak group, and this same guy talked again. And afterward, I said, "Al, I want you to know one thing. That guy made one of the best talks that I have ever heard. I really enjoyed that." I said, "You know, there about 1956, when he finally bought him a big book," I said, I almost shed a tear. And Al said, "Thank God, I don't believe I could have listened to that dude one more time, you know." But we learn, you know. We learn by experience and strength and hope. We learn in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had two guys in our group. Oh, I hated them. We had a guy named Nick. I preached Nick's funeral about 2 years ago. Nick was one of the sweetest men that ever lived. I loved him. But when I first came into AA, he just drove me up a tree. He was a religious nut. He was so heavenly high, he wasn't no earthly good. I mean, he just up there, you know. And old Nick would get up behind that podium day after day, and he'd say, "I woke up on the shores of Lake Dallas looking down the golden pathway to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I'd say, "The old bastard woke up with a hangover and the sun in his eyes. I know what it was. I've been there, you know." We got another fellow that had cirrhosis of the liver, and God, he was proud of it. Old Joe's liver, he talked about his liver until I tell you, he'd get up there, you know, and he'd say, "I had 297 pints of blood, and my liver was this long, and it's hard as a rock," and all that. Well, I had about all that I could handle. So one night I got up, and I said, "Look, I love you. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but if I have to listen to the golden pathway to AA one more time, if I have to listen to Joe W.'s liver just one more time, I'm going to puke." And I went over and sat down. A guy named Ollie M. came over and put his arm around me, and I thought, he's going to tell me what a good job I did. "I have expressed the opinion of the group." He said, "Ray, I know exactly how you feel. We're not too damn crazy about that piano story you tell all the time either." But you see, we come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and they tolerate us, folks. We don't bring anything here. We come in and we learn to admit we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. we come and then we come to and we come to believe that there is a power and we begin to enlist the aid of that power. And then Al says, hey, I want you to take an inventory. And I said, oh, well, I did that already. Thank you. I said, I already did an inventory. He said, where is it? I said, I wrote it on the back of a matchbook cover and I lost it. He said, no, you're going to take an inventory. I couldn't do that. I tried. I just couldn't do that. See, I'd sit down, you know, and I'd get me a pack of paper and a box of pencils and some coffee and turn the TV on and get the stereo set just right. And I'd wait for God to reveal to me what my inventory was. And nothing ever came. I've done that in sermon preparation time, you know. I found out, you know, the more I study, the more inspired I get. Have you ever noticed that? A fellow told me the other day, he said, if you pray for potatoes, you might ought to reach for a hole, you know. Well, that's kind of the way I was. I was sitting there waiting for divine inspiration. It didn't come. So I had a friend that was in prison, and I liked him. I could go tell him anything. He couldn't get out and talk to folks, you know. And I went over and I said, hey, look, I got a little problem with my inventory. He said, nothing to an inventory. He said, anybody can do an inventory. Just take a piece of paper. And he handed me a piece of paper. He said, draw a line down the middle. Write good on one side and bad on the other. He said, now on one side, he said, on the good side, I want you to write down, there's nothing wrong with me. That was kind of embarrassing. It was true. It was kind of embarrassing. That was why I was having so much trouble with an inventory. I didn't want to write that down. But if he said it, it was all right. So I wrote it. There's nothing wrong with me. He said, see, that's good. Now, on the other side, right, I'm a damn liar. That's bad. Now he said, you got your inventory started. Go home and finish it. And I did. You know something? I found out, you know, that for everything good about me, there was something bad. And everything bad, there was something good. And I was just about average. I wasn't all bad and I wasn't all good. I was just about middle of the road. I had done, you know, I found out something in my inventory. I was not a bad person. I was a person who had done some bad things. I was not an immoral person. I was a person who had done some immoral things. That's not the same thing. But if I dwell on it, I could become that. And that's why I needed to step forward. Then Al says, well, we're going to do Kill Baptist down in South Georgia, and God knows everything. I don't have to tell him. I wrote it. I don't have to tell me and another person. It's none of their business. But you know something I have discovered? Step 5 is one of the most beautiful steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. You admit to God for forgiveness, to yourself for understanding, and to another human being for humility. And once you have achieved forgiveness, understanding, and humility, folks, you've got a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never really lived. I don't believe I ever really lived a day in my life until I successfully completed step 5. To God for forgiveness, to myself for understanding, and to another human being for humility. And then step 6 came along. Then they messed me up, the whole thing. We're entirely ready to have God remove all of our defects of character. You've got to be kidding. You know, if they hadn't put entirely and all in there, that would have been a snap. You know, all our defects of character. I was ready for God to remove faith. My kids had some delicious ones I wanted taken away. My employers had bunches of them, you know. Teachers in school had defects. But all of my defects of character, have you ever realized what that really says? You know? If you have all of your defects of character taken away, who are you going to talk about on the way home? You know? What will you talk about after the next AA meeting? Can't gossip. That's a defect of character. You will have those things removed. You know, you will become ready to have them removed as they become a problem to you. I got to tell you the little story. Some of you have heard it before, but, you know, I used to have a terrible temper. I don't have it anymore. See what I mean? It's still working. I don't have it as bad anymore. First compliment they paid me after we came into AA, I never forget. I had a Volkswagen. Oh, God, if I don't have a Volkswagen. And I took it in for repair. I just took it in to have it tuned up. And I came back, and it was $69 for a set of points and four spark plugs. And I told the guy, I said, I don't owe that much money. He said, well, when we were taking the distributor loose, one of the screws got loose and fell down in the distributor shaft, and we had to pull the whole thing apart to get to that screw, and you had to pay for the labor. And I said, wait a minute. I don't owe that. He said, well, if you don't feel like you owe it, we'll just take it off. I said, I don't, and you will. And he did. And we got in the car, folks, and Faye literally had tears in her eyes, and she said, I'm so proud of you. And I didn't feel real proud because I was really lockjawed about that thing. And I said, why are you proud of me? And she said, you never did call him a son of a bitch. She said, you never did. And I got to tell you something. Lady, do you have anything down there that says what I just said? You can clean that up some if you want to. I just watch her. She's just working over here and she blushes every now and then. And I used to preach down on the Mexican border through an interpreter. And I know that he wasn't saying a lot of times what I was saying. And that's good. I had this terrible temper. I came home one day and my son was working on a lawnmower. I never will forget it. I'm totally unmechanical. I don't do things mechanical well at all, but my son's worse than I am. And he had a fit-all wrench and a vice grip plier and a little old sledgehammer, and he was trying to get the wheels loose on this lawnmower to lower him down. And he had three wheels lowered and one was froze. And I said, let me help you. And the first thing that happened is that vice grip slipped off and my hand went in the blade and just peeled the meat back, you know. And I picked up that sledgehammer and beat the motor slap off the lawnmower. Just very calmly, just beat the motor off the lawnmower. And I looked up and my wife and daughter were standing in the door of the garage in the kitchen door, and my wife said, well, Mr. Serenity. And I said, I'm not going to let this thing upset me, and I threw the hammer through the garage door. And then I drove down to Gibson's, and I paid about $90 for a new lawnmower and $135 for a new garage door. And then I understood what step six was. See, I was entirely ready to have God remove what I can't afford to have. I cannot afford a temper that costs me $175, $200, $250 every time I lose it. And so I realized that as those things become a problem, I'm willing to turn them loose. And so step seven is very simple, folks. Step seven says we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. The way that works is you do the asking and let God do the removing. That's the only way it'll work. Now, you don't have to tell him. You don't have to give him any orders. You just humbly ask him. Well, then we got through with all that, and then Al said, it's time for you to work on other people. He said, you got to make a list of all the people you've harmed. And I said, okay, and so I did. And he said, now you got to make amends to them all. Well, I did to everybody but one. There was one fellow that I didn't like very much. And I had stolen some money from him, and he had cheated me, and so I thought we was even. I ran around all over Irving, and I made my amends. And some folks graciously accepted them, some didn't. But I did them. Except for this one guy. I left him off. And you know something? AA went sour. AA went bad. I'd go to an AA meeting. They'd talk about step nine. We'd have a discussion meeting. It seemed like they were always on step nine. If we had a speaker come over, always want to talk about step eight and nine. I just quit going. See, I had a little defense mechanism that I used after I quit drinking. I didn't give up all of my insanity. I'd go home and go to bed. I'd go to the hospital if I could get in. One year I was in the hospital eight times. Wasn't sick. I just went to the hospital. After I sobered up and got a little sanity and did get sick and wound up in the hospital, it like scared me to death. I'd go to the hospital and see at the hospital, they'll treat you nice for two or three days. I went home and went to bed and covered up my head, and Al came over there. He had a tendency to do that, and he said, "Get up," and I said, "I'm sick," and he said, "Everybody knows that, but get up anyway." He said, "You got something that's holding you back, and I don't know what it is, and we need to work on it." And I said, "Well, it's step 9. And he said, "You've got somebody you haven't made amends to yet." And I said, "Well, I can't. They'll put me in jail." And Al said, "You'd be better off sober in jail than you would drunk on the street." And I said, "Al, I just don't think I can go and face that man." And my son was 16 years old, and he said, "Daddy, I'll go with you." And we drove back to Georgia, and we went up and talked to the man, and he had already heard that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into his office that day, and I said, "I need to talk to you." And he said, "Well, before you do, I just want you to know how proud I am that things are better for you and that your family's all together and you're happy." And I said, "Well, maybe you won't be when I tell you what I've come to tell you." I said, "I stole some money from you." And he reached back and he pulled out a ledger out of the drawer and he opened it up and it was marked with a paper clip. And he said, "Is this what you're talking about?" He had known it all the time. And he said, "Just don't worry about it." He said, "It's been written off a long time ago. You just go ahead and I'm happy for you." And I took off. Boy, I was thrilled to death. I got in the car and my little boy said, "Daddy," said, "what happened?" And I said, "I told him." And he said, "What did he say?" And I said, "He said, forget it." And he said, "Daddy, you can't do that." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because you owe him the money, Daddy." And I said, "Well, he doesn't need the money." And my little boy said, "Daddy, he never did. But all your life, you've made it a practice to try to get something for nothing. And if you get away with this time, you don't have a prayer." And I went back up those steps and I told that man, I said, "I got to pay you." It took us 5 years to pay him. We did. We got back in the car. We started back to Texas and we got to Jackson, Mississippi. And my son pulled off the interstate. I said, "Why are you stopping here?" We had lived there for a little while in another one of my geographical cures. And he said, "You owe a man here some money too, Daddy." And I said, "Well, I don't have any money." He said, "Mother gave me a check. And she said, if you did the right thing in Georgia, we were to stop and pay this man too. And if you didn't, it wouldn't make any difference one way or the other." And I came on home. I went back to AA. We began to practice the principles in our affairs. I began to take a personal daily inventory, continuous inventory. I began to seek God's will for my life. And you know, a funny thing happened. Nothing happened. I'd just go to them dumb old meetings. And I'd sit around and I'd talk. And I'd teach the 12 steps. And I'd take inventories. I'd go over to Al's house. I'd go home. I'd go back to AA, and I'd go to work, and I'd go to AA, and I'd go back over to Al's house, and every now and then we'd go out and eat a hot dog, and we'd come back. That's the same old thing. One Saturday afternoon, I was sitting there in the club. They were getting ready to have bingo, and I looked around, and everybody was laughing and talking and cutting up and having a good time, and I just got mad and left. And I went down to Al's office and I said, "I want to ask you one thing." I said, "The only thing good I can say about you is you never have lied to me. And I want to know one thing. Why is it that nothing good ever happens to me?" And Al looked at me just as serious. He never cracked a smile. He said, "Maybe, Ray, you're one of those people good things don't happen to." And I believe that. I believe that with all my heart. And Al looked at me and he said, "I want to ask you a question, Ray. Where do you sleep?" And I said, "I sleep at home in the master bedroom with my wife." He said, "Huh. How are your children, Ray?" And I said, "Al, we got so many teenagers hanging around our house these days. Sometimes I have to go to the service station and use the restroom." We still had a daughter at home. Now, I said, how are things at work? I said, well, I've been promoted. I'm head of the department now. And he said, huh, how did you get down here today, Ray? And I said, in my new car. And he said, I hope you stay around AA long enough for something good to happen to you. I went down to a little park in Irving and I sat under a pecan tree, and I can't talk about it without getting emotional, but I sat there that day and I cried for about 2 hours. I thought back on the day that they carried me away to AA. And my little boy went up to the store on the corner and he took the change out of his pocket. And he called his grandmother in Kentucky, and when she answered the phone, all he could say was, Mom, Mom, my daddy don't drink no more. I thought about the day that Faye invited me to a voice recital and I didn't want to go. She made me go, and it was my daughter. It was a private recital, and she sang in 5 languages. And I didn't even know she could sing. I didn't know. I had missed all that. I sat there and I thought about the day my son graduated from high school. He graduated in Irving Stadium. And I looked at all of those people, thousands of people there watching their kids graduate from high school, and I thought they all expected to be there. And I was there because it was my privilege to be there, because I had been invited by a son who was no longer ashamed of his daddy. I thought about the next year when my daughter graduated and how she had brought all her class over and introduced them to her daddy. I thought about my son who was in the Air Force in Germany, and he was a Mars operator. He would call me over the radio hookup. Everybody could hear from Texas to Germany and back who had a radio, and he would never ever hang up without saying, Daddy, Daddy, I love you and I'm proud of you. And I sat there and I cried because I was so dumb and blind and stupid. And I remembered the day that I got the letter from my mother-in-law. We had found out that she had cancer. And she wrote me a letter and she said, Ray, I'm not afraid to die, but they're giving me cobalt treatments and they put me in this room by myself, and it frightens me. She said, I found a way to overcome my fear. I spend my time praying for you and your problem. Boy, that wiped me out. I caught a plane and I went up to Kentucky to see her. And she said, Ray, I don't know why God has spared you, but he has a special purpose for you. I went to AA, went home, I went to work. I even started going back to church, but I didn't like it. I went to the pastor one day and I said, you know, y'all are all phony down here at this church. He said, why? I said, if you really want to see people loving other people, you ought to go up to AA where I go. I said, they love you up there. And he looked at me and he said, if you think you've got something that the church needs, instead of criticizing the church, why don't you bring it to us? And I said, well, I think you have to get drunk to appreciate it. I was sitting on my bed one Sunday afternoon and I was miserable. I hadn't had a drink in about 4 years. I was sitting there with the big book in one hand and my Bible in the other. And I was trying to put the universe together. And I looked down and my big book was open to step 3, which says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, which means exactly what it says, that your needs and my needs are not the same, that God's relationship to you and God's relationship to me may be two entirely different things, but yet you don't have to be wrong for me to be right. And I looked over at the Bible, and it was open to the 9th chapter of the book of Acts, which is the account of St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. And I really realized for the first time that I had a calling. It scared me to death. I went in and told Faye. I said, "Faye, I think God's called me to preach." And she said, "What and to who?" I said, "Faye," I'm going to tell you this and I'm going to shut up. I said, "Faye, I want to go to school. I don't believe that being an alcoholic prepares you to be a preacher or a counselor any more than having your appendix out prepares you to be a surgeon. If you're going to deal with people's lives, you have a responsibility to prepare to do that." And I said, "Faye, there's a class starting at the seminary. I want to go." And she said, "All right." And I said, "I'll tell you what, let's do." I called a real estate lady on Monday morning and I said, "I want to sell my house." And she said, "Well, we'll put it on the market." I said, "You don't understand." I said, "I want to sell my house right away. I've got to leave in 5 days." She said, "There's no way we can sell your house." I said, "Look, don't talk to me. Talk to God about this." I said, "He has told me I've got this to do. Now you talk to Him about it." And I said, "By the way, while we're at it, when you write up the contract, I've got to have cash. I need it by Thursday. And I'd like to sell it furnished." She said, "You're crazy." And I said, "Maybe. My wife thinks I am. My kids think I am. And I'm not real sure myself. But I'm going to tell you something." At 12 o'clock noon that day, she brought a young couple over to our house and they paid me cash money for that house and we moved out in 2 days. I went to school, prepared to preach. Now, I didn't want to be a big preacher. Billy Graham had his thing and Oral Roberts has his thing over there in Tulsa. You know, I just wanted a small church, 5,000 or 6,000 parishioners. You know. Didn't want anybody with any problems. Didn't want anybody upset. I just wanted some happy Christians, you know, that would let me expound on my vast knowledge of theology. And I might do a little counseling on the side, you know, between golf and stuff like that. I didn't get anything. We were in South Texas. Faye was working at South Texas Children's Home, and I'm sitting down there, and nobody's beating my door down. I want to be a pastor. I want to be a preacher, you know. And I'm ready and I'm prepared. I'm out of school and nothing's happening. And I ran down to the AA club to see if I could find somebody who would give me some sympathy. Folks, I went into 310 South Adams Street in Beeville, Texas at 5:30 one afternoon. There was one man sitting in there and he was sitting in a chair by himself, had his head down. When I closed the door, he looked up and he had tears running down his face. And he said, "My name's Carpe. Who are you?" And I said, "My name's Ray Vowell." He said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "What do you do for a living?" And I said, "I'm a Baptist preacher. I'm trying to be, but I don't have a church." And tears began to flow again. And he said, "My brother-in-law is pastor of the Calvary Baptist Church. And he's had a heart attack. And I was down here meditating and praying that God would send us a preacher. I spent 5.5 years at Calvary Baptist Church. You see, everything that's happened to me has happened through AA. All the good things in my life I've gotten because of AA. Not too long ago, I was playing golf with a doctor. And he said, "You know, I worked for 22 years, day and night, to get to this." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I worked day and night. I went to school, I studied, I took call, I've operated, I worked in surgery, I've done everything just so I could have Thursday afternoons to play golf." I said, "That's great." He said, "How did you get here?" I said, "I quit drinking."